Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Anna Kempner is the 18-year-old whose life ended on the Carnival Horizon cruise ship. We're learning more and more about how that took place, and we're learning more and more about the background and more specifically the chaos that surrounded her life. It really is a behavioral minefield. You have an 18-year-old girl found hidden under a bed on a cruise ship, a 16-year-old step-sibling publicly labeled a suspect, a stepmother invoking the Fifth Amendment, a father saying almost nothing, a biological mother melting down on TikTok, and a grandmother saying the boy doesn't remember what happened, and an emotional wreck when he found out. And all of this happening inside one small cabin on a ship that's now back in Miami while the FBI tries to figure out what actually happened in those few critical hours. So today, I don't want to talk about law. I want to talk about human behavior. What does this kind of concealment tell us? What does I don't remember tell us? Where does panic end and intent begin? And how does the FBI work a case when the evidence is in one cabin, but the noise is coming from the entire family system that is blowing apart in public? To do that, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Unit, is with us. From a behavioral standpoint, Robin, what does it say about a person that Anna wasn't just found unresponsive, but she was found hidden under a bed, wrapped and covered and concealed with life jackets jammed up next to her?
Panic. I mean, the first thing you see that when you see something like that, you're like, wow, someone panicked because, you know, it's reactionary is what it is. And it's typically, I looked up the stats on all these things. I typically didn't cover juveniles in my career. So I did a lot more research, deeper research on juveniles, our brains and how they develop and the differences. And that is actually a very typical response of a brain that is still forming when they hit panic mode, when they hit fight or flight, because basically when you know you did something wrong, so that's a key right there. Knowing you did something wrong, the first thing you try to do is hide it. You're not thinking out, you know, like projecting out, which young brains don't do or undeveloped brains don't do, is they don't think out, hey, if I do X, Y, and Z, the result's going to be this, this, and this. It's really all immediate, all right now. I got to hide it because someone's going to freak out if they find it. So that says chaos right away of a young or undeveloped adolescent brain that's not functioning except in fight or flight mode.
And that's interesting because obviously we have that here. We have a 16-year-old that is being looked at as a suspect right now as of this recording. No charges have been filed, but if it pans out the way it appears to be panning out, there likely will be at least something that comes down at some point, because we're looking at a case here where it's a cruise ship There's cameras on all the doors. There's key cards for every door. And you can pretty much, through process of elimination, determine who is in or not in a cabin. And if it, like I said, it pans out the way it does, it will narrow itself down pretty quick to that or the boogeyman. What does it tell you about whether death was intentional or accidental or anything like that? I know we're talking about a younger, underdeveloped brain that's going to panic, but does this speak the way the body was concealed or anything to which we've learned thus far, which does include the grandmother claiming that the 16-year-old said he doesn't remember what happened. This was a fleeting statement that she had caught, and also that he was an emotional wreck, basically, when they found out that Anna had been found. What's your take on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of different things in there, Tony. So let's go first on the non-remembering aspects of this. And when I did the research on this, because I mean, we just got done, not done, but just took a break for a second of the Epstein issues with Jenna. And Jenna and survivors of that kind of trauma actually have extremely accurate memories for faces, not necessarily timelines, but for faces because of the trauma that's inflicted on them. So I was expecting kind of a different result looking at the of this, because I was thinking, oh, the guy's got to be lying. But actually, the probability of a unformed, before the prefrontal lobes fully formed, brain of someone who's 16 years old of not remembering a traumatic event is actually pretty dang high. And it's high for both if you're the perpetrator and also high if you are actually just walking into the room and witnessing it. So either way, the trauma is high, but there's actually a very, there's a difference though. And this is where a great investigator and a great interviewer is going to be really able to suss this out. And that is timelining. Timelining, accuracy of timelining, and also the vagaries of the like 2 or 3 hours before the event and 2 or 3 hours after the event. If it's a real loss of memory and he wasn't involved, then there's going to be a lot of fog about 2 or 3 hours before the event itself and then about 2 or 3 hours after. And you're going to have a really, really good baseline of that same sort of fog that's coming in. Now, if he is the perpetrator and he still has a non-recollection of doing the event itself, then it'll be tighter and you will have emotional responses in there and you'll be able to timeline it on the same sort of sequence. And like when we do statement analysis, we always have someone say, hey, write out what you think the events are with that day. You know, tell me what you did in the morning, tell me what you did at the end of the day, and write out your day. And you can then actually see the blocks of time someone typically writes in. And then when someone gaps a time, you can say what happened in here, then you can explore that. I would have him do that as well, but he's going to be very vague intentionally during the time block in which the event happened. He's going to be a lot sharper, closer into that event than if he was just a bystander that happened across the body or found out about it later. And then what will happen is after he gives his first statement, he's going to start building upon it because he's actually starting to invent ideas. He's inventing storylines. He's inventing excuses because that's what the brain starts doing. When you are creating a fiction, he's going to keep creating that fiction, thinks, oh, I got one more thing that's going to be a little better. Oh, I got one more thing that's going to be a little better. And so basically getting a very good interview, as I heard you talking to Jennifer Coffendeffer about this, and she was really spot on talking about someone very well trained in juvenile interviewing really needs to be employed in this because there's a lot of things in here. Like I would enjoy the challenge of doing it, but I haven't done it before. I think I'd be able to do it. And I say me, someone like me that's a typical interviewer that does criminal investigation, things like that, and typical homicides and things like that as well. But I would think a skill set really particular to a 16-year-old suspect is going to be really necessary in this.
Is that assuming that he would be trying to not tell the truth, that he'd be trying to find a way out of this and saying that initially, that it wasn't me, if that's how the interview is going?
I think initially he's going to try to say it wasn't him. That'd be
or downplay,
right? You use a great word downplay there. And here's what
I don't know how you downplay after I said it. I'm like, how do you downplay?
So here's how you do that. So, a typical interviewer, and this is where you're going to blend the two worlds of a typical homicide investigation or interview of a bad guy and a juvenile. And that's so the juvenile angle of this. You know, I don't want to pretend to be an expert on that because I don't. We'll just infuse what we just learned here. But typically what we're doing is when we're interviewing someone that is very heavily evidenced that they're really a main suspect, like in this case, you do RPMs, rationalizations, projections, and minimizers, because you want to bring closure. You want them to be able to tell their story because, you know, so here's how you help someone rationalize. Listen, I know you didn't intend to do this. This was just a heat of the moment thing. You're playing, you're roughhousing. You've probably done it a million times before and you got her in that chokehold and you've probably done it before and it was no big deal and she's done it back to you. But you know what? This time, for some reason, it went a little bit too far. Maybe she did something to you that kind of set you off and you didn't realize what you did. So that's understandable. So that's how you help someone rationalize away. You just murdered someone. And so you help them do that. And then you minimize it. Listen, it could have been much worse. You could have been on an outside balcony and thrown her out the window, but you didn't. You know, you knew she's eventually going to be found. So you put her under there. And so you got to kind of figure out what to do because you're emotionally hijacked in that moment. And so that's how you help someone get over the challenge of confessing that they did it, because you don't want to show them their shame. So, you know, want to compare this to the Delphi interview? What we're doing is you are saying, hey, I got you. I got a lot of evidence here. But you know what? Evidence is cold. Let's hear your story. There's a lot going on here. You have a history with her. I'm sure you care deeply for her. We've seen you care deeply for her. So you help them. Granted, might be creepy caring, inappropriate caring, but that's not from their context. This is where you have that deep act of empathy. You see world through their context and lens and help them feel safe to confess what the truth is and what happened without pushing them over that ledge saying, you got it, and you're going away for the rest of your life. Because then there's nowhere to go. Then he gets defensive, shields up, clam up, let me talk to my lawyer, you know, and they start lying, diffusing, all that stuff. So that's how a great interviewer works them towards feeling safe to share their story, because you know what? The world is painting you in a really negative light right now. Social media is erupting all over the place. But you know what? I see you. I know you. There's something different here. Let's hear your story.
Do you risk putting them, in a territory where we're already talking about someone, if they're being honest, that may not have the best memory on this? And we talked about how that memory is going to likely kind of cycle through. How do you do it's got to be a tight walk where you also, you don't want to push them away of let me lawyer up and I'm not talking to you. And there's also the, I'm just going to give you the response you want because I'm in anguish here. This is trying to get a response without anguish and without I'm going to lawyer up. This is, let's just try and be honest. But do you risk it all in that of almost doing the same thing of the anguish and the pressure like we saw like in the yogurt shop murders and Delphi and that sort of stuff? Is there a risk, though, of what you were saying? You know, you probably roughhouse a lot, blah, 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 blah. Of them just leaning into that because it's what's being presented in front of them, almost leading a witness to a certain extent, because you're essentially saying, here's what, you know, you probably did, you know, and rationalizing it down in a way that sounds safe to talk about. But are they just, sometimes could you risk them just talking for the sake of talking because they don't know what else to do? I mean, you're getting information out, but how can you be sure that information is going to be accurate and also not part of a false memory or part of building up a story in their mind because they're thinking, oh yeah, okay, they're giving me this out, or kind of is that part of it to get them somewhere else?
The only way I've ever done it, I know exactly what you're talking about with the yogurt shop murders, because they did a lot of lying, and it's not illegal for an investigator to lie during those types of interviews to get a confession, and that's why that was a tough one to watch and assess, but there's so much different in play in that one. It's not something I subscribe to. So what you do in this case, which is different than the yogurt shop murders that we saw, is that you stick to the truth, you stick with the facts that you know, and you lead them down the path of saying, hey, I saw this is what I know, And so, again, cops are allowed to use conjecture of what they think happened as they lay out the evidence for them. And so now it's up to the suspect to either confirm or deny exactly what the cops are laying out. And so and what happens at that point is now you just press them. If you have more evidence that refutes, you know, what they're saying, you present them with the evidence. So when someone is doing an accusatory interview, or which this would be, if he doesn't already confess, is that only bring them down the road of using, and then you dribble in their actual facts and details and data. Now, you can use props. People use props all the time because props can give an impression of more knowledge than you actually have. So that's why interviewers will come in with like big stacks of files and put them down. And, you know, oh, remember in The Matrix, you know, when Mr. Anderson, you know, Mr. Anderson's Neo, you know, but Smith comes in and he opens up the files and he says, "We've been watching you for some time, Mr. Anderson." Mm-hmm. You know, so you can use props.
I was thinking more along the lines of like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, like the kitty that talks and then the king, or Lady Elaine. She was a scary one. You get Lady Elaine talking to you, that bitch, that'll make somebody talk. That was a scary woman. I think we all know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Lady Elaine. Anyway, continue. I had to interject that.
So, I mean, I was always one for, I don't lie. I'll, because I don't think you need to. If you're doing a good job with a report, and now here's the key too. Well, you need a lot of
paper. I don't want to interrupt you, but in other countries, they don't even allow you to do that.
Right.
In their interviewing processes. Right. That's a unique thing to the U.S.
And I think it's very unique to, I think, again, I don't, because again, we're talking behavior here, not law. I'm not really clear and concise on that, because what happens a lot of times, all times, before you actually go in and do a subject interview, you get laid out very, very specifically from prosecution what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do in that room, what you got to get and not get. And so here's the case. So say the Delphi case. What should have gone on prior to that interview, if it's a well-coordinated, well-led, and which you hit this last time, you know, process of prosecution, is before those cops went in to interview Richard Allen, they were told exactly what they could and couldn't do in that interview room. What, you know, and whether they could lie or not lie in that interview room, because it's up to the prosecution, who's now got to put it before a jury, and a defense attorney's got to say, well, the cops lied and they misled them and they got a false confession, all those things. And so that's why I'm trying to remember all those many years ago what I was taught at the FBI Academy about being able to do that. It was never clearly said you couldn't. It was just told that in a specific search, you know, there was extenuating circumstances, I guess is the best way to put it.
Sure.
But I never had to, because I don't believe in that. Truth is so much easier to work with when both as a bad guy and as a good guy. And if you're doing a good job, because remember, when you're in action interview room and you're interviewing a bad guy, your goal is to get to the truth. And the only way you're going to get to the truth is to be an advocate, not just for the victim, but really for the person you're interviewing. If they see you as an ally that's trying to understand them, understand the, you know, walking a mile in their shoes, and understand the steps they took and why they took it, granted, this works and is effective as long as the person has empathy. If you're dealing with high level psychopath, no, like this does not work with a coworker. No way in hell, because he doesn't give a rat's ass. It just, you know, it's like talking to a wolf, glazes right over him. But this kid, apparently, if it's him and they're interviewing him, he's got an emotional response. It's all right. So we got someone with levels of empathy here. So him thinking, and not just thinking, but knowing that whoever's interviewing him is actually an advocate for his truth of all the circumstances. Because remember, this kid, if it's him or whoever did this, feels like they had a really good reason why things escalated the way they did from his perspective. Your job is not to agree with it. Your job is to understand what he thought that perspective was, so his story can get out. That's always what the interviewer is doing. Let me get your story out, because that will be the great mitigator before the jury. That will set, you know, the whole thing, the truth will set you free. Well, actually, it'll let, you know, if he's got a conscience, which it sounds like he does, good. It'll make the interviewers and prosecution jobs much easier to deal with this, because you're not dealing with someone who can just shut up, clam up, and do the whole, you know, fake tears of Murdoch or the zero affect of Koberger or any of the other crazies. So it'll be really interesting to see where he falls in the spectrum.
We are talking with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, about Anna Kempner and the cruise now homicide, as it is being labeled, on the Carnival Horizon. This just recently took place. Anna Kempner, 18, 16-year-old step-sibling sharing a room. The accusation or the suspicion is right now, because he is a suspect as of this recording, that something happened there. Her cause of death has been labeled a form of asphyxiation, basically the neck type hold where you cut off the carotid artery and you do it long enough and you kill somebody. And that's what they're saying was her cause of death. Robin, we tend to think about all of this in adult terms. If you hide a body, you must have murdered someone. You know, that's not always the case, but you know, some people are. There's other cases right now we're watching where Brian Walsh is trying to argue that right now. You know, the David case is right. We don't know what's going on there. But from a behavioral perspective, how different is a 16-year-old's decision making compared to an adult in a moment like this? Especially when it comes to that split second, what do I do when panic setting in versus, oh my God, she's passed out, she's not breathing, I should call 911.
Much less rational with a youth and adolescent before the prefrontal lobes fully form. So anyone basically under the age of 22 to 24 is going to act pretty goofy. Mm-hmm. And like that. And believe it or not, I looked up the stat. So here is actually the number that, because again, it doesn't make sense, because like if this was a mistake, our logical adult brain says, well, hey, if an accident happened, the first thing you want to do is pick up the phone, call 911 and get the local people on the boat there to come help and assist. But also Jennifer Coffendeffer with you earlier said this is a really good point too. She would have passed out long before she died. And the fact that he held that choke long enough to not just let her pass out but die, that was pretty traumatic. That was a lot of rage could be funneled in there. So that's part of it. But the stats on this, 16-year-olds, roughly 60 to 70% of the time, they're going to do that kind of reaction. They're going to try to hide the body. They're not going to report it. They're not going to try to pretend it wasn't them. They're not going to say it was an accident. 60 to 70% is what the recent stats are showing on that. So
that's
more common than you think.
God, I mean, I can see that's a scary one when it comes to like a body. Like, I get it. Like I scratched your car or something when I took it out to Burger King or like, and that sort of thing. But the concealing a body, like, that's I would think that would be a little more. I'm not screwing around with this.
How many times do we cover so much that every single moron that we cover on this, and everyone we've covered is a moron, everyone, doesn't matter the IQ at all, zero EQ, zero emotional intelligence, and even less so the younger you get, and that is their ability to problem solve and maintain emotional regulation. Zero, absolutely bottomed out. And that's why I thought, Bob Mata, I know, said it with you too. There's a damn good thing there wasn't a window.
Yeah.
That body would have been stuffed through it and right in the ocean.
A window or right off the balcony. Yep. There's cameras there too, but at a 16-year-old thinking,
they're not thinking cameras. No. He's thinking right in front of his nose. The interesting thing too, if you dive deeper on the behavior here, is I was just thinking about my own kids and how my kids solve problems. We never see the world as a bad day or a good day. The day is just a day. It presents us challenges to work through. And so that's how a healthy brain and healthy family dynamic does things. Hey, if something happens, we come together, we work the problem, and we do what we can to resolve the issue and challenge that we're facing. And so what we have in here is not just the 60 or 70% of people doing this, but why did he do it?
Yeah.
Fear. He feared reciprocity first. Not just from law enforcement or anything like that. He feared it because of the family. So there's a family dynamic going on there that's cascading on top of this of fear. Now, granted, is that unusual or not unusual for a teenager to do that? No, they said the stats are really high that the first thing they do is try to hide the body because of fear. But I can't imagine that in my family or your family ever happening like this, because it couldn't, because it was like, hey, it's a really bad, stupid thing, man, but we're going to work the problem.
I mean, the dynamics of this family, without going into all of the details, I think very easy to sum up. Springer. If you ever watched Springer, this is that. This would easily fit onto that show.
And to that, I'm sorry, Tony, because I really want to bring that point up because I just kind of arc into it. I apologize.
Yeah.
When this first broke and I first saw the initial statements coming out, you know, it's a lot of times we'll ask, you know, what was your first impression? My first impression, it was family. We got issues. And here's why. The first thing I heard was, and I'm paraphrasing what I heard, this is what my brain absorbed, was that the daughter was sick at dinner the night before, went to bed early, and the parents then didn't see her again. She wasn't at breakfast and then didn't see her again or think anything of looking for her until around coming up on lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
That opening statement to me said, because when you hear of missing person, I think how my brain first works is, am I going to look outside family or inside the family? First thing I said, all right, we got to look inside the family. And it's not because anything's wrong, that they're right and wrong. What they did was the behavior was a little incongruent with what parents would typically do. Again, this is just typical. There's outliers all over the place. This is not to judge the way people are raising their family, not family, especially on a cruise vacation, all that. But when someone says they're sick, again, this is only just what was reported. When a child says they were sick, they go to bed early. You don't check on them. There's other kids in the room that are also didn't report anything, not checking in with the parents. And no one's at breakfast this morning saying someone's missing or not knowing where she is. And so see what I mean? There's a lot of gap of time that there was not a lot of families. Again, we're talking law of averages, have guardrails.
Yeah.
And this the first thing I'm hearing is zero guardrails.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can see an argument on the other side for not being super concerned. She's 18.
Yep,
she wasn't feeling great. And who knows what the parents were told at breakfast by the ones who did come up, you know, oh, she's sleeping it off. Who knows? And that will, if they said anything, which we don't know the answer to that, that will certainly play into it, especially if they make a statement like she was sleeping or something and she's literally under the bed. That would be different. I could see that. And it's probably a regular pattern of their dynamic of probably very loose communication. Is it super healthy? Is it the way I would do it or you would do it? No. I can see, but I can understand why there's that loose, because it's probably, again, this is all conjecture, probably just how they communicate, good, bad, ugly, whatever it may be.
100%.
But there's, yeah. Yes, it's
a deviation of an arc of what you'd expect.
What you'd expect, but this family, if you look from what we do know, they're like this. It's everywhere.
And that's why I'm looking there.
Yes. And that's the thing. I mean, and if somebody wants to get into all the details of things that we've learned about this family, we have videos about it. I mean, just the mom alone who was not on the trip, her mother, the birth mother, oh my God, I broke down her hour or 13 minute rant about herself.
Yes.
There's a video of that. And the allegations that were made way, way back when Anna was like, what, 4 years old or something, or even younger. The dad ends up marrying allegedly an 18-year-old that allegedly was the babysitter prior, and allegedly not. There was a filing that was dismissed about an inappropriate relationship between the father and a minor. We don't know if the minor is the one who turned into 18 and became his new wife. That's what a lot of people are assuming right now. We can't confirm that, but we have seen the actual filing. I've gone and gotten that. The filing exists, but it was dismissed. No charges were ever filed there. So not in any way saying he's doing anything with kids, but obviously somebody felt uncomfortable enough to make this filing, and then he marries the 18-year-old. It looks a little weird.
Sorting
and that's normalized.
Chaos.
And that's normalized essentially then for the rest of her upbringing. And then the 18-year-old becomes the mom that apparently she was a good mom, according to the strung out mom. allegedly. I mean, this is why I'm saying this is like Springer. And then there's a ton of allegations against the dad. Again, I mean, it's mudslinging left and right. Who knows what is exactly true? All we can do is base on what we've actually seen, like those filings and such. But again, just the chaos. That's the point, is the chaos. There's so goddamn much chaos here that was normalized around this girl by 18. Yep. It's amazing that she was on, from what we understand, the bright path that she was on to escape this family and get on with her life and go do good things. She had very bright plans ahead of her, seemed to be very determined, was about to join the military, was about to embark away from ship, you know, Camp Chaos here. But unfortunately, Camp Chaos burned down first.
Yeah.
It's very sad, but these are the dynamics that she was around. When it comes to, obviously, they're going to be questioning the family. They're going to want to know what was going on. They're going to want to know if there's any sort of motivation here, any signs that something was going on with the 16-year-old towards the 18-year-old Anna. And this makes it a very interesting dynamic because they all have a self-interest, I mean, for the most part, I would think, to not talk, to not incriminate the 16-year-old, even though something might have happened. And most families are going to try and protect their own, even when there was violence against another one of their own. What kind of a challenge does that present to investigators when they're trying to better understand the dynamics of what went on here?
Yeah. As an investigator, I'm going to be obviously talking to all these people, but realizing that what you're getting is going to be a lot of chaos coming out of their mouths for a while as well. I'll tell you, the most interesting thing is going to be their cell phone data. I think there's going to be a lot of, if we thought we saw chaos and creepy now, I think as they start digging into the cell phone data for all these people involved, you're going to get a much clearer picture on what was going on there. Home computer, cell phone, and just sit back and watch that show. Because from the first moment that I saw the smoke by that first statement, nothing to surprise me, because it's fitting a pattern that we've sadly seen before. I think it's going to get potentially darker than we've seen already. And I think it's not going to come from any of their statements. I think right now, I mean, each individual, like you said, is probably in their own personal survival mode. I think the grandparent, again, pure conjecture, grandparents, if they aren't completely connected, are trying to figure out the chaos because they probably presented a great 5-second highlight reel to the grandparents. And meanwhile, hiding the super ugly dysfunctional chaos going on behind the scenes. I would not be surprised would whatever is uncovered, because I think there's a lot there.
I mean, what is it going to mean here if we find out that there was warnings to whoever made the choice of who's staying in what cabin? I'm assuming the parental figures who paid for the cabin, I'm assuming somebody made the choice of who's staying in what cabin. I don't know who that is, but if it is someone that had knowledge, whoever that may be, if they had knowledge that there was an uncomfortableness, a threat, a whatever it may be between Anna and the 16-year-old, and that was ignored, and the parents or whoever, again, I don't know who it is, decided, well, we're still having y'all bunk together, that could mean a lot. The grandparents had said in an interview that, and I found this to be interesting, they had said in an interview that, well, we said to the kids, you know, if there's any problems, you know, any blah, 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 you know, you can always come to our room. I thought there was an interesting thing that was brought up of if there's any things that the door was open, basically, that you can come to our room and everything is all good and you know, you'll be fine.
They had to say that.
That was an interesting thing to say. And that made me wonder a little bit about did they book the rooms but did not have knowledge? Because I could see that. I could see a situation in which the rooms were booked by grandma and grandpa. Pure speculation here. They have no idea there's anything going on here between the 16-year-old and the 18-year-old. any sort of issues. And mom and dad also don't want to tell grandma and grandpa that there are. So they're just telling the kids to suck it up and deal with it. I could see a scenario like that, where that the placement of the people is innocent. But I can also see a scenario where it's just completely ignored as well. And if it's ignored, that's what I'm interested in. Considering we've also seen the boyfriend, the ex-boyfriend of Anna, come out and say that he tried to warn the family about the uncomfortable, the bizarre behavior of the 16-year-old, allegedly, that he had witnessed on a FaceTime call with her earlier in the year or late last year. I don't recall exactly what the timestamp was, but it wasn't that far back.
Yep. So that right there from the boyfriend says to me that in a way that Jennifer did a great job talking about that too. It was impromptu. It was natural. It didn't look like it was fabricated when he gave that statement. That's leakage. And so if the boyfriend that far removed is getting leakage, again, not of specifics, but there's some weirdness, there's some uncomfortableness, there's unhealthiness going on there. Everyone in the family knows it. You can't be, there is zero probability that a boyfriend picked up on something on a FaceTime call in a split second that the rest of the family is not seeing. There's zero probability of that. And so what are people doing with that? It's either witting or it's like don't want to believe it. It's all these things that go into your mind. There's a lot of dark places you can go with it. And there's a lot of places of just plausible deniability. But either way, people inside the family knew there was issues. The grandparents don't make a statement like that unless they're getting some sort of, you know, tremor in the force or as I'm calling it, the wobble, you know, that there's a wobble, a behavior wobble there. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, if this is the way human behavior works. If there's leakage and someone that far removed is picking up on it, not over multiple times, but just something like this, the closer you get to the wobble, the more pronounced it is, and now to not do anything about it means that you are either involved in it, you're denying it and turn a blind eye to it. And so, what would make someone, so say she has a problem with the 16-year-old as has been alleged or, been insinuated by anyone. So what would inspire her to say okay to the room? Fear, threats, disclosure, shame. I don't know what it is, but so what? Because remember, fear is one of our great motivators to do actions and to not take actions. You know, we saw it with the hiding the body. The way he hid the body was fear of being discovered. So why, if you're actually knowingly having a problem with one of your siblings or step siblings, in whatever capacity it is, whether it's just threat of violence or threat of sexual assault, I don't know what it is. There's a fear factor there. What would inspire you to say yes to going on a cruise with him and being booked in the same room with him? Fear.
Yeah.
There's no other reason.
What would it mean, just playing in hypotheticals here, in terms of charges against the 16-year-old, if the story ends at, you know, I was roughhousing, I did the chokehold, and it was a horrible accident. You know, I went too far. You know, I'm an idiot. I feel horrible. And that's it. There's nothing, and that there is nothing else, that there's no digital trail. There's no evidence that points to some sort of weird relationship or fantasy or vile or whatever. There's just nothing. It's just pretty normal, run of the mill, you know, step sibling relationship shit. That's not looked at as criminal. If it just ends there versus they find a trail, not necessarily if I'm planning on putting her in a chokehold and killing her on the horizon this weekend, but more so, whatever, something that points to frustration, anger, sexual desire, you know, rejection, something along those lines, something that would basically look like some sort of a motive, some sort of an emotion that happened pre, or a pattern of emotion pre-cruise that then looks like here it erupts in that cabin and now she's dead. How does that change the type of charging? Could that be looked at as a premeditated murder if it wasn't necessarily planned, but there was a lot of angst about it and maybe some sort of writing or evidence of it versus just nothing, even if it's not direct, you know, I'm going to kill her, but I hate her. Who knows? I'm pure speculation.
Right. Yeah. I don't know the legal side nearly as well, but I would. So here's where my mind automatically goes though, as you're describing that. And I'm with you. This isn't just a 0 to 100. I'm going to kill someone. This was an arc of behavior that's been established over time in this relationship. And also, it's also been part of this relationship because this is what makes this even a little bit more uniquely different than a typical homicide between two individuals. And that is, he's a 16-year-old and she's an 18-year-old and they're both living at home, which means, you know, where's the culpability of people that should have kept them separated and kept them safe? So I think that's going to play into this a lot, too. I think when they start interviewing people and they start looking at the digital footprints and they start looking at texting and they start looking at all the things go behind this, as well as they start interviewing teachers, they interview principals, guidance counselors, employers, all when this web is going to be really vast, I think, to get a clear picture. But and once they have that clear picture, or at least a clearer picture, then they're going to know what to do, I think, more effectively about when it comes to charges. Because is it just this one, you know, misguided kid that everyone did all they could to prevent this thing from happening, and it was just a one-off? We thought he was healthy and we thought he got the counseling, he's on his meds and all those things, and it was just a freak of nature kind of bad event? Or was this a pattern? Because that's what they're always looking for in cases, is was this a pattern and an escalation of going of this individual being allowed to go down the dark triad of abuse, of taking advantage of this abhorrent behavior, and it finally escalated into this and it was being ignored? Or was it one off? So that I think that's what they're going to come down
and
to.
And then is that criminal beyond what the kid's doing? You know, is it right. Criminal if you're the parent and you're ignoring it? I mean, obviously, like in a school, this is not a school shooting, but we are seeing parents being charged now in school shootings where they can't just say, well, he's a bad apple. You know, he just, you know, kids are, you know, you can't predict it. You know, no, you bought him the gun, you ignored all these signs and all this. If it's something where, well, we ignored all these signs, all these issues that seem to be going on, we do not know the answer to any of those questions.
Right.
And it could be a mix. It could be a mix of, yeah, he had problems and we were getting him help.
Right.
And he still did what he did. Obviously, the more examples there are of the family trying to get the kid help, if there was indeed an issue here, there's so much conjecture in this.
For sure.
That, you know, that certainly plays to the reality, if in fact it is, that they were aware, but they were doing everything they could, because you can't just kick the kid out on the street.
Right.
So that's a fine line between kids are being kids, suck it up, deal with it, and we're getting really, really concerning warnings from our daughter and completely ignoring them. There's a difference between that and two teenagers bickering back and forth. Yep. And that's what they're really going to have to try and determine.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be, again, I think the cell phone digital footprint is going to be really paramount in this. I think they're going to learn a lot from that. And they're also going to learn a lot from interviewing teachers and friends and other members of the community that had interaction with the family, the father, the mother, and the siblings themselves, too, to kind of see, to get a really much deeper understanding of the dynamics that were going on, healthy, unhealthy, or, you know, were they falling within a pattern or was there just nonstop chaos? I really can't wait to see what's on those cell phones. It'll be really interesting. And it's not just for this time, and they're going to need to go back for a period of time to establish this arc. You know, she's 18 now. I would go back as far as when she first started living with the dad and they were getting divorced from the meth mom.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, we don't know if that's what she said. She was on drugs. We don't know what the drugs were, but one can make a guess considering one can make a wild guess, you know, considering, but according to her, it's a genetic gum disease that made her lose all of her teeth that her parents both had, who were also addicts, she says. So
girl.
Who knows? Yeah. Yeah. The story that will be of that arc of life from basically birth to her unfortunate, very young death is probably one where she lived a lifetime of trauma 10 times beyond
I think the
average human being.
And that's why I say it's going to be a lot uncovered, I think, in this digital footprint. And as they do a deeper dive on this, it's going to take some time because this is going to, it's going to take a lot of leads are going out. And I know just listen to Jennifer, you know, because we don't, and the Bureau don't prosecute, you know, minors. And so they're going to figure this, it's got a lot of stuff to figure out on that angle. And I really think this is going to be more than them just trying to figure out whether they're going to prosecute a 16-year-old as an adult, not an adult, or I think there might be other things that we find get involved in this case.
I think they just cracked a freaking egg open and it's going everywhere and the yolk's broken.
And we might save other people because of it.
I agree. It's one of those where I think, again, my conjecture, my feeling is there's a lot of things here that have been skirting under the radar for a long period of time. I don't know exactly what they are, but this is the thing that got people looking at them, that got the authorities notified, that now has the FBI investigating it. And whatever had been flourishing or existing for grand old periods of time is now going to come out in the open, and it may have absolutely nothing to do with her murder. But who knows what else, when you have chaos like this in a family, you know, sometimes it knows no bounds. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope this is it and they can heal and move on. From what I've seen so far, I have my doubts, but
I hope it's just a horrendous, tragic mistake, but likelihood of that is low.
We'll find out. Let us know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That is where you will find us. You're also invited to press subscribe. You're demanded to press subscribe. Please do press subscribe. We would appreciate that. Trying to get to 100,000 subscribers before the end of the year. We're very close to it, so please do hit that. And also, if you're looking for a stocking stuffer, a gift, whatever you'd like, this is a great one this year. Unbreakable Alliances. It's Robin Dreeke's latest book and available wherever books are sold, so please do go and check that out. Until next time, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening to another edition here of Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Four seasons greetings to you all.